This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The election is less than a month away, and we're reminded yet again.
The Russians seem to have really figured out how to really integrate their disinformation campaigns along with actual infrastructure hacking.
Will it be 2016 Redux? Plus, long lines and food shortages in Cuba. With a robust black market, Cubans are trying to adapt.
We don't like sardines, but we buy them anyway because we know that we can trade them with our neighbors later on.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today on The World, the Canadian government labeled a tribe there extinct in the 1950s. Try telling that to thousands of the tribe's descendants today.
I am an Arrow Lakes native person, and I am not extinct.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for making it here this Friday. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded today. Berit Riis-Andersen, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, made the announcement in Oslo. The award went to
the World Food Programme for its efforts to combat hunger.
It's not that unusual for the Nobel Committee to give the award to an organization. We'll have more about the history of the Peace Prize in just a few minutes. But first, let me bring in Jane Howard, spokesperson in London for the World Food Programme. And just a reminder that the WFP is part of the United Nations. Jane Howard, first of all, congratulations are in order. What was your reaction when you heard the announcement today?
Well, I have to say, I received a call from a Japanese journalist, and I thought it was one of my colleagues just kind of winding me up. It was so stunning and such wonderful news. I couldn't quite believe it.
So a Japanese journalist asked you about your reaction before he'd heard the news?
Absolutely, yeah.
Is there an overall picture you can draw of world hunger today? Like, what is the global situation?
The situation is not good, and what worries us is that it has got worse in the last 5 or 6 years. We were making steady progress to eliminating hunger. That's one of the global goals we're trying to meet by 2030. But what we've seen is that there's just been a surge of conflict, mainly, in the world. And that has led to a big, big rise in the number of hungry people, because if you have to leave your house because of conflict, you leave your animals, you leave your little patch of vegetables, you lose your job, and you become destitute. Then we have understood the impact of climate change. You know, the weather is going crazy with more floods, droughts in unexpected periods. What we've seen that nobody really predicted this year is the coronavirus crisis has just put another layer on top of that, and had undoubtedly increased the number of people in need of our help.
So I've been under the impression that there are fewer people going hungry today than, say, 25 years ago, but it sounds like you're saying that we're actually going in the opposite direction.
That's it. It's gone into reverse. If you'd asked me 25 years ago, we were making steady progress. But if you think about the world today, conflicts like Yemen, where we're feeding 12 million people per month, South Sudan, which is constantly just on the brink of famine, long-running civil conflict. Nearly every time there's been a situation near famine in the last 5 or 10 years, it's really been because of conflict. And we help those in different ways. In South Sudan, it's airdrops and taking food across flooded swamps by canoe. But in other countries, say India, we help the government run their public distribution system. In other countries, we work on longer term resilience building so that instead of just your food runs out and that's it, you have to have improved methods of storage. And it can be very, very simple things. And there are ways to do it. And that is what the committee has recognized.
There is, of course, the pandemic. We know that has affected hunger globally. But how long will the pandemic last, and how far down the economic scale it'll drive things, all kind of unknowns. How do you see the pandemic affecting hunger in the months and years ahead? And what's the World Food Programme plan?
The problem, I think, will not be the actual virus, but the economic effects. If you're a day laborer and you don't work because you're under lockdown, you might not be able to feed your family that evening. Another quite important factor is the impact on the rich countries, because many people in poorer places depend on remittances sent by, you know, an auntie working, you know, in the Gulf or a teacher working in London. The last thing I would say, which is a really fascinating thing about the pandemic, is that it's changed the face of hunger. The new face of hunger are people living in towns and cities, because actually those are the ones who depend on having cash in their hand to buy food at the market. They don't have that kind of safety net. If you lose your job in a city, in many countries of the world, there isn't a sort of a cushion. There is not a safety net.
So can you give us some specific examples of World Food Program projects, work on the ground, things that might be applied to this unprecedented situation where many are experiencing food deprivation, some for the first time?
Well, I'm thinking of some really striking pictures that came in from a suburb of Lagos. It's called Makoko.
In Nigeria,
and
yeah.
It's known as, in Nigeria, it's known as the world's largest floating slum. We are reaching new people there, people who traditionally have managed reasonably well because it's a very vibrant economy. Other places where schools have closed, we've had to change the way we've worked and actually provided food to families of children who would have been at school. So I think it's raised a huge amount of awareness of that importance of what you would just call a safety net, a way of reaching the poorest families really quickly. This is the time when you really need that cushion to protect the poorest of the poor. And that is why the honor of winning the Peace Prize and all the attention that brings, that's why it's so significant and so humbling for us.
Jane, what is your message to people who don't have to worry about going to bed hungry? What do you want them to remember about the work that the World Food Program does?
I think even people who don't have to worry about going to bed hungry, you know, we all know what it is to feel hungry. And we all know how difficult it is to manage that relationship with food. So my message would be, you know, to value food and using what you do have. But also, I think it's that empathy that you need to imagine what it's like to have no food, your family to have no food, and to make sure that the hungry families of the world are not forgotten.
Jane Howard, spokesperson for the World Food Program. Again, Jane, congratulations for the honor, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
This year's winner seems like a relatively safe choice, but safety is not what always drives the pick for the prize. The Nobel Peace Prize is no stranger to controversy, so much so that it's become a punchline.
Selena, you have put me in a terrible situation. You have just admitted to being a war criminal.
Do they give Nobel Peace Prizes to war criminals, Minna?
All the time.
Exhibit A there on Veep from HBO. So how and why one of the world's most coveted awards has gone to controversial figures? Here's the world's Sarah Birnbaum.
I like to divide peace laureates into two groups. There are the ones that seem obvious, like the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan leader in exile.
I accept the prize with profound gratitude on behalf of the oppressed everywhere.
Then Elie Wiesel for bringing the world's attention to the Holocaust.
This honor belongs to all the survivors, to their children, to the Jewish people.
Desmond Tutu for his opposition to apartheid. Tutu began his 1984 acceptance speech with a traditional song. Let's call them Group A. Then there's Group B, the Nobel Peace laureates who have some questionable records or who have gone on to do some truly awful things. The Henry Kissingers, for example.
Nothing that has happened to me in...
He won in 1973 for negotiating a ceasefire in Vietnam, even though he was the architect of America's secret war in Cambodia.
From 1969 to 1973, more than 500,000 Cambodians died.
Kissinger wasn't even a popular choice at the time. A comedian joked that political satire became obsolete when Kissinger won the Peace Prize. Dan Smith, the director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, says sometimes controversial people win the prize. It's sort of the way this particular award works.
I think that what the committee tries to do changes actually from year to year. If there has been some kind of a breakthrough towards peace, they will very often focus on that and they will give an award.
And Smith says if you're going to reward breakthroughs in peace negotiations, a lot of times those involve people with complicated backgrounds.
When you're dealing with real conflicts, people have got their hands dirty, and probably that is the reason why they are able to play a part for peace. Because if they never got their hands dirty in that conflict, they really wouldn't have a role there.
In the popular imagination, the Peace Prize is still seen as a lifetime achievement award for kindness, charity, and the fight against oppression. So when it's awarded to Kissinger, or say Menachem Begin or Yasser Arafat, Dan Smith says, you get some cognitive dissonance.
People do tend, and I think this is a mistake, but they do tend to see the prize as a kind of honor for the whole person, for the whole life, for everything that they have done. And I don't think that's at all what was intended ever.
And at times, it's not so clear what the Nobel Committee's intentions really are. Take Barack Obama, for example. Here he is speaking with Stephen Colbert.
Do you have any awards or commendations?
Well, I have almost 30 honorary degrees, and I did get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, really? What was that for?
To be honest, I still don't know.
That's pretty good.
The 2009 prize was more about what people hoped Obama might accomplish. No more nuclear weapons. Peace in the Middle East. It was a lot of pressure, and it didn't really pan out. Henrik Erdal is a Norwegian political scientist who directs the Peace Research Institute in Oslo. He says the Nobel Committee will often use the prize to spur action rather than reward things that have already happened.
The committee could, of course, choose an easy path and always award it to processes that have been completed and finalized, and you can, you know, tell years after that that it's been a success. But the committee has chosen a path which I think is sensible and important, in that they're identifying processes that are worthy of a bit of a nudge.
Sometimes, Erdal says, the approach has worked well, like the prize that went to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos in 2016 for his efforts to end the civil war.
This was just after the referendum that had turned down his peace agreement, and the prize pushed that process probably over the finishing line.
Santos revised the agreement with the FARC. It was ratified by the parliament, and hundreds of people gathered in the central plaza in Bogota to celebrate peace. Que viva, que viva, que viva la paz! Que viva! But sometimes the gamble doesn't pay off. In 1994.
And ultimately, what the crowd reacted to the most was none of the words, but the moment when Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin finally shook hands.
But ultimately, that handshake was not enough to bring peace to the Middle East. So is there a risk of delegitimizing the Peace Prize? I mean, just when Google search on the Nobel Peace Prize, you get things like, the Nobel Peace Prize is a political tool of the West. Graham Wood in The Atlantic suggests that the record of peace laureates is so spotty, maybe the Peace Prize should be eliminated. But Henrik Erdal disagrees.
The Nobel Peace Prize is the most significant prize there is in the world. So not the most significant peace prize, but the most significant prize that anyone could get. So you get the attention of a whole world.
And if sometimes it seems like it's been given to the wrong people, that's okay. Because sometimes you get peace. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum. قصدك حال چه
خبر آوردی؟ Emotion does not have a language in music. Even if you don't understand the words here in Farsi, you can still feel it. از کجا و از که خبر آوردی؟ The voice of Iran's legendary vocalist Mohammad Reza Shajarian. The lyrics here come from a poem about a dandelion. Shajarian is asking the flower if it has any good news from afar. Millions of Iranians in Iran and Farsi speakers around the world, in Afghanistan, Tajikistan, are mourning his death this week, following a long battle with cancer. Through decades of political discourse in Iran, Shajarian's voice and music were an ever-present reminder that before anything else, before politics, religion, disputes with other nations, there is a beating heart inside all of us that yearns for freedom. As one man wrote on Twitter upon learning of the death of Shajarian, with his art, he beautifully and consistently expressed the sorrows of 80 million Iranians. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Counting down 25 days now to the general election. Each Friday until November 3rd, we're chatting with a couple of our reporters about what they're hearing and seeing.
The whole world is watching.
The most important election.
Human rights.
Climate change.
Race. Immigration.
Value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world.
This week, safe to say, there's a lot on voters' minds. The vice presidential debate on Wednesday, of course. President Trump battling and playing down the coronavirus. Weekly jobless claims worse than expected as layoffs continue. And Trump continuing to undermine the integrity of the voting process, leading to surreal speculation for a democracy. Will the candidates trust the results? With us today is Lydia Emanuelido in Athens.
Hey, Marco.
And Rupa Shenoy in Washington.
Hey, Marco.
Lydia, you've been on the cyber and tech beat for the show. The 2016 election and the foreign interference we saw then by Russia and others shook a lot of people's faith in our system. When it comes to foreign interference, what threats are election security experts concerned about? What are they watching?
Right. So, Marco, I think of the threats that election security researchers and the intelligence community are tracking right now, basically as interference 2.0. So some of the actors attempting that interference are the same cyber criminals and state-backed actors that we saw in 2016. So Russia, China, Iran. The tactics are a bit more advanced and evolved, but the goal now is the same as it was 4 or 5 years ago, and that is to undermine trust in our elections and in democracy altogether.
So more advanced tactics in 2016? Explain that.
So I spoke about this with Jake Braun. He heads the Cyber Policy Initiative at the University of Chicago, and he's also the author of Democracy in Danger. And he said that foreign powers that want to meddle with the election are in an opportunity-rich environment right now because we're in a pandemic. Many people are voting by mail for the first time. So, you know, there's already a lot of uncertainty. And at the same time, foreign actors have fine-tuned their tactics since 2016. Here's Braun.
The Russians mainly the Russians, seem to have really figured out how to really integrate their disinformation and misinformation campaigns along with actual infrastructure hacking.
What is infrastructure hacking?
Yeah, here's what he means by that. So let's say, for example, that there's a cyber attack into a state's voter registration roll. Of course, if any information in that database is changed or deleted, that could create a lot of chaos before, during, and after the election. But even if that attack is really unsophisticated and the hackers don't actually manage to get into the system and change any information, what comes after it can be just as chaotic because Braun says foreign actors can publicize that hack and then they can tap into the public outcry, the media coverage, the conspiracy theories around it and elevate them, whether it's through fake accounts on social media or websites that they create to masquerade as fake news sites. And all of that, of course, can make people question the integrity of our systems and the integrity of the results.
Yeah, those hacks work in so many different ways. Rupa Shenoy in Washington, when it comes to the election and the actual voting process itself, like the casting of ballots, we do have systems in place to help people get confidence in the process, like election monitors. How much of a role can they play in shoring up confidence in the election?
So there are domestic and international observers. The international observers, the biggest group that does the work is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE. They were formed specifically for this reason, to help shore up confidence in elections. But that was in developing countries. I talked to Judith Kelly, a professor of political science and dean of Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. She says they weren't prepared for this to happen in a modern democracy.
These are the kinds of things we've seen written up in reports around the world criticizing how other countries run elections. And to have them now in our own country, it's profoundly disturbing.
So the group I told you about, the OSCE, it started its mission in the U.S. Last week, and it wanted to bring 500 observers. But because of COVID concerns, it actually ended up being about 130 people who will be here. And so they're trying to pick out in the country, like, places that they should be, key places where they might be able to see activity and be the most help. But really, their actions are very restricted because state officials are the ones who determine where these observers can go, even though they're here based on obligations made by the federal government.
So, Rupa, how does election monitoring work now that a lot more people are voting by mail? Are they going to be monitoring mail-in ballots?
I mean, you're probably asking about the actual process in the U.S. Postal Service, and that's a really big question that's concerning a lot of people, and there doesn't seem to be a clear answer. The most likely problem that might happen with mail-in voting and the Postal Service will actually be ballots being received. So with ballots coming from overseas, there are a lot of different concerns going on there because historically, the group that's used mail-in ballots overseas the most are the military voters. There's conflicting information about this, but members of the military, particularly retired generals, are coming out this election and saying that many of those military ballots are never received by states, and that's a very big problem.
And I just want to add that when it comes to overseas and military voters, the concerns aren't just around mail-in ballots. Some states actually allow those voters to use online systems, whether those are websites or apps, to vote, to cast their ballots. And even there, there have been, you know, researchers at MIT have looked into at least one of these apps that are one of the most widely used apps called Votes. And there are lots of security risks with online voting as well.
And there's another big concern, Rupa. President Trump has asked his supporters to, quote, protect polling places. So now there are these fears of widespread voter intimidation. Could that actually happen? And what would that look like?
Yeah. So the bottom line is that it would be illegal in many cases. In many cases, it's a federal crime for people to go to polls and openly carry a gun. Many states prohibit carrying concealed weapons as well. There are specific rules against brandishing a firearm in a way that could intimidate voters. And there are legal restrictions on who can engage in poll watching and rules in place to ensure accountability. When it comes to the president and whether he may, you know, deploy the military or National Guard or something like that, people might speculate about that. There are a lot of limits on his ability to do that. Basically, he can't. Lydia, one thing I was wondering about is in the days after the election, as we're trying to sort out the result, will there be some sort of official who will be able to come out and say, we had this kind of online interference and this was the impact?
So the intelligence community is certainly monitoring all these threats really closely. There are tons of independent researchers, academics who are doing some of that as well and providing real-time information and analysis. But all of that can only go so far when you have a president at the top who's denied even really well-documented instances of foreign interference, right? I mean, that's what President Trump did after the 2016 election, despite overwhelming evidence that Russia did try to interfere with the election. And then on top of that, as Marco, you said at the top, Trump himself has been questioning the integrity of mail-in voting. He hasn't committed to honor the results of the election. So, you know, arguably foreign powers trying to interfere and undermine trust in the election only need to do so much when we already have our own president doing it.
Really great discussion. The World's Lydia Manalidou in Athens and Rupa Shenoy in Washington. Thanks to you both and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
To explore more of our election coverage, head on over to theworld.org/2020election. Sea turtles lay their eggs on the beach. Poachers often steal them. So a researcher came up with a solution, a high-tech decoy.
I kind of had an aha moment of thinking of putting a GPS transmitter in a false sea turtle egg.
007 technology to protect endangered animals. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Across the globe, a record number of new coronavirus infections were recorded yesterday, around 350,000 cases. It's a steady upward trajectory, putting even more pressure on scientists, pharmaceutical companies, and governments to find a vaccine quickly. The World's Ilana Gordon covers global health for our show. There is a lot of pressure to get an effective vaccine out to people, Ilana. This fall was seen as kind of the time when we'd have more answers. How close is the world to a vaccine now?
Here's the big picture, Marco. About 40 vaccines are being tested in people right now. And of that, about a dozen are in those most advanced clinical stages. This is when they're being tested in large groups of people in the real world, everywhere from South Africa to Brazil. But that being said, China and Russia, they've moved ahead before the results of these final stages and approved vaccines that are being given to people.
What does that actually mean, moving ahead before the trials are complete?
Well, scientists worry about that because these trial designs have a purpose. They help show whether there's complications and the degree to which a vaccine is effective. You might remember one of the vaccines that's farthest along in clinical trials is from AstraZeneca and Oxford University. Several weeks ago, they paused the trial to investigate a potential adverse event, meaning someone who got the vaccine developed a health problem. And these sorts of pauses, they happen with other vaccines, too. It's part of the process.
Early on, as we should remember, Trump suggested expect something as early as this fall, i.e. a vaccine. So how do we know when a vaccine is really ready to go? And is that happening anytime soon?
Well, this week, Marco, a standoff went down between the FDA and the White House over this very thing. I talked to Dr. William Moss about this. He directs the International Vaccine Access Center at Johns Hopkins University. He says it's up to regulators in each country to review the evidence and decide whether to approve a vaccine. The FDA is that regulatory agency here in the U.S., but it's more than that.
The FDA has served as kind of a global standard in the rigor in which they evaluate products. And, you know, many other countries or regions, you know, might accept, you know, an FDA approval.
And so, Marco, what happened this week is that the FDA put out stricter rules for giving emergency approval to a COVID vaccine. And specifically, vaccine makers would have to follow trial participants for 2 months after they had their last dose of the vaccine to rule out any major side effects. A lot of these vaccines require two doses. So that all pushes the timeline at least into November. And then it was reported that the White House wanted to block those new FDA standards, but then the FDA published them.
So this going back and forth business, what could that mean for people's willingness to even take a vaccine when it's available?
That really worries Howard Koh, a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. He helped lead vaccine efforts during the big H1N1 pandemic as Assistant Secretary for Health and Human Services.
I worked for a Democratic president and multiple Republican governors. I never considered that life-saving vaccination would ever be a partisan issue.
And so Koh says there's an independent vaccine approval process that's in place. It's essential, it works, and it's important to have that protected to protect against politics. But again, this erosion in trust, it's playing out in polling. We're seeing big drops in people's willingness to take a vaccine if it becomes available initially. And there's also this growing perception that the vaccine process is being driven by politics.
Willingness to take it is just one challenge with a vaccine. Can't forget manufacturing, distribution, and just sheer access to it, which means, Ilana, we'll be checking back in with you again soon. The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The Sinaixt. It's a tribe in Canada that is officially extinct. Legally, they do not exist. It's been the case for decades, but Canada's Supreme Court is now weighing a decision that could change that. Reporter Emily Schwing has our story.
The last member of the Sinaixt tribe in British Columbia passed away in 1956. That's when the Canadian government declared the Sinaixt extinct. But try telling that to thousands of their descendants who are still very much alive.
Way, everybody.
Shelley Boyd is a member of the Arrow Lakes, or Lakes Tribe, and a Sinaixt descendant. She lives across the U.S.-Canada border in Washington State.
I am an Arrow Lakes Indian, and I am not extinct.
I am an Arrow Lakes Native person. And I am not extinct.
Rick Desitel, who also lives in Washington, is the defendant in a legal battle that's now being waged at the Supreme Court of Canada. He and Shelley Boyd have been broadcasting a visit to Ottawa on Facebook Live for the last few days.
My hopes and beliefs today are that the Supreme Court will make the final decision in my favor and open up the country to hunting, fishing, and other rights and stuff that we have in our traditional territory for the future generations of the Sinaixt people.
It's been more than a decade since Desitel went hunting alongside his wife Linda for a ceremonial elk in British Columbia. Under Canadian law, that hunt was illegal. In the lower court decisions, Desitel was acquitted, but multiple appeals have landed him in Ottawa.
Morning.
In the case of Her Majesty the Queen against Richard Desautels, for the appellant, Her Majesty the Queen, Glenn Thompson.
Thursday was the one and only hearing in this case. Justice Malcolm Rowe summed up the question at the heart of Desautels' legal fight.
Isn't it as simple what the BC Court of Appeals said is those communities and nations who were encountered by Europeans at contact had rights, and whether they're on one side of the border or on the other side of the border, they're successors, and by virtue of being successors, they hold the rights. Is it any more complicated than that?
Rights afforded to Canada's Indigenous people were established in 1981 under Section 35 of the Canadian Constitution. Attorneys General representing five Canadian provinces and one territory argue that because current Sinaix tribal members do not reside in Canada, they do not have rights there.
You have to have both.
Christopher Rupar represents Canada's federal government.
You have to have the individual say, this is the ancestral community and this is the contemporary community, and I have a flow through to both.
The prosecutor in the Supreme Court case is Glenn Thompson.
The case is not about whether Sinaix people exist or have rights in Canada. It's about whether the Lakes of Washington State and the United States have constitutional rights despite clear words recognizing and affirming the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada.
Desautels' defense attorney Mark Underhill argues that regardless of whether people like Rick Desautels are considered Sinaixed in Canada or members of the Lakes tribe in the U.S., if they do not have access to their traditional hunting grounds, they are simply cut off from their cultural identity.
To be Sinaixed and to be able to practice your culture, they have to be able to hunt in Canada.
British Columbia has argued in the past that the Sinaixed left Canada to take up farming in Washington State, but previous decisions in the case haven't supported that claim. Mark Underhill told justices it's unlikely the Sinaixed would have left Canada voluntarily.
But I want to be very clear that abandonment has no place in Canadian Aboriginal law, because what it does is completely obliterate the entire concept of Aboriginal identity that is tied to place.
Legal counsel representing at least a dozen First Nations from across Canada spoke in support of Desautels' case. Paul Williams is from Ontario.
I'm the lead negotiator for the Beskutamukati Nation in negotiations with the Crown about Aboriginal and treaty rights and title to land in Canada. You clearly understand that this case is about how nine non-Indigenous judges interpret four words, Aboriginal people of Canada. Either those words acknowledge the timeless connection between an Indigenous people and its land in Canada, or the word of is a possessive term, a word of control, that enables the Crown governments to distinguish between our Indians and somebody else's Indians.
As the hearing came to a close, dozens of Sinaixed members in Washington State made their way to the Canadian border. Due to COVID-19, they can't enter Canada, but they rallied in support of Rick Desautels. A poster advertising the rally went up on social media last week. "We didn't cross the border. The border crossed us," it says in bright red letters. Rick Desautels' attorney says he doesn't expect a final decision from the Supreme Court of Canada for at least 6 months. For The World, I'm Emily Schwing.
It was known as the special period, the time in Cuba just after the fall of the Soviet Union. Without Soviet money, the economy in Cuba tanked, and food shortages kept people hungry for years. Now those shortages are happening again. There are a few factors at play, and our friends at Economist Radio in London discuss them in a recent episode of their podcast, The Intelligence. Jason Palmer is the host. We're going to listen to one part of your podcast in a moment, Jason, but give us a setup. Who did you speak with, and what exactly are Cubans experiencing right now in terms of food shortage?
Well, we spoke to Roseanne Lake, who's the Economist's Cuba correspondent, and she likens shopping there to an endurance sport. Cubans are long since accustomed to long lines, but now she says shoppers need to get into two different ones, one for a number that gives them a time slot, which might actually be the next day, and that time slot allows them to get into another line to actually get into the store. But all that waiting might not pay off because plenty of items still just aren't available. Here's Roseanne and a bit of that conversation.
It's difficult to find what you need, so all of that queuing may not necessarily pay off. There are rations on basic goods, and this is to discourage stockpiling. And the Cuban government was very crafty in rolling out a new app called Portero, which is used to scan the IDs of every shopper, and they ensure that you don't shop too often. Sources that I've spoken to said, well, I was just headed over to the shop to buy some shampoo and hot dogs, neither of which were available. My app was scanned, and as I was leaving the store, I was told that I wouldn't be allowed to return to that same store for a week. And Cubans have done what they usually do very well. They've found ways to sort of improvise. So some of my sources say, well, we don't like sardines, but we buy them anyway because we know that we can trade them with our neighbors later on.
So what exactly is going on here? Is this a pandemic effect?
COVID-19 is definitely an important part of it because it has decimated the tourism industry, which is an important source of hard currency for Cuba. But even before the pandemic, the economy was in a very difficult spot. Venezuela hasn't been able to provide Cuba with the same volume of crude oil, which Cuba then refines and sells around the world in exchange for hard currency. Also, Cuban doctors, they've become less popular around the world, and they were also another critical source of foreign tender. So it's really a very unfortunate and rather perfect storm that was magnified by the pandemic that has left the Cuban government with far fewer sources of revenue to buy the products that it sells in state-run stores. And this, of course, has led to shortages of basic goods and queues and apps to control what you can buy.
Doesn't that also drive a bunch of gray market, black market stuff?
It absolutely does. But the black market in Cuba has been thriving for quite some time because prior to the pandemic, these shortages already existed. But the saving grace of the black market at the time were Cubans referred to as mulas or mules. Cubans who would sort of make a living of traveling to places like Mexico or Miami to buy things. They would bring it back into the country and resell it on the black market. But of course, as a result of the pandemic, there's no travel in or out of Cuba. And so these mulas have sold off their supply. And what's being traded on the black market instead are U.S. dollars.
That's Roseanne Lake, Cuba correspondent for The Economist. She's speaking there with Jason Palmer of Economist Radio. Jason, we heard from Roseanne that there's been this drop in tourism because of the pandemic, also political unrest in Venezuela. So just a couple of factors at play causing the food shortages right now in Cuba. But we also heard Roseanne mention the U.S. dollar. That has influence, too. Remind us, Cuba has a dual currency, right?
Yeah, so there's the Cuban peso. They're about 25 to the dollar. And then there's the convertible peso, more or less one-to-one with the dollar. Cubans can use the currency that's tied to the dollar at special stores called MLCs, and they tend to have more stuff on the shelves. So more Cubans want dollars so they can go shopping there. But that has created the black market trading that Roseanne described. I mean, the whole system has always created distortions in the Cuban economy. It keeps wages low. It discourages domestic production. And as Roseanne told me, it's just a mess.
There are reports now that the dual currency economy may not last much longer. Is that right?
Well, in late July, state media started to hint that the currency system might finally be eliminated by the end of this year. And that, of course, has led to even more lines, but this time at banks and at exchange houses in an attempt to convert money back into Cuban pesos. And it should be said that there's been talk of doing away with this system for absolutely years, and it's never come to anything. So I think it's a case of just wait and see.
Just a small slice there of the economic situation and food shortage taking place in Cuba right now. You can hear more of Jason's conversation with Roseanne Lake on the Intelligence podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Jason Palmer, thanks very much. Speak to you again soon.
It's been a pleasure.
6 years ago, Brazilian authorities began looking into a money laundering scheme at a gas station near Rio de Janeiro. Operation Car Wash ended up becoming perhaps the biggest corruption probe ever in Latin America. It took down two Brazilian presidents, senators, and hundreds of petroleum executives. Now Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, is ending Operation Car Wash. He said, with typical Bolsonaro flourish, there is no more corruption in the government. Mauricio Santoro is a political scientist at the State University of Rio de Janeiro. How surprised are you that Bolsonaro has pulled the plug on Operation Car Wash? I mean, has all the necessary work been completed?
The car wash operation was very important. It was really a watershed moment in terms of fighting corruption in my country. And although it had many problems, it was something that really helped us to understand how serious corruption is in Brazil. And Bolsonaro was perhaps the politician that better understood the political power of the car wash operation. Bolsonaro was able to present himself to voters in 2018 in the presidential elections as the outsider that was going to clean a very corrupt political system, drain the swamp, to use a very American expression.
Yeah, ending the operation doesn't seem like he's draining the swamp. It all initially involved a gas station involved in money laundering, but then ballooned into this international scheme involving billions of dollars in bribes. I mean, is there a simple way to explain how it all worked?
It was basically a corruption scheme in Petrobras. It's a state-owned oil company linking politicians, big building companies in Brazil, and how the companies paid the politicians to get privileged contracts with the Brazilian state, and that this corruption money helped to finance their campaigns. And it implicated all major political parties in Brazil, left and right, moderate and more extreme. And of course, that many things are still disputed, especially around former President Lula, who was the most popular politician in Brazil in the last 50 years. And many people still believe that he was innocent, but at least that he was not guilty of everything that he was charged of. But anyway, he went to jail. He wasn't able to run in the presidential elections in 2018. And Bolsonaro was able to present himself to voters saying more or less like this: "You know, nobody ever respected me as a politician, but that was because I am not corrupt."
Is there any evidence that Operation Car Wash was close to uncovering corruption involving President Bolsonaro?
Not so much the car wash operation, because car wash was more about Petrobras and other state-owned companies. But we have investigations in Rio de Janeiro by the local police and also by federal authorities linking the Bolsonaro family with the paramilitary groups in Brazil and with lots of illegal actions. For example, the Bolsonaro family has a very strange habit of buying real estate, paying cash with suitcases full of money, which is, of course, something that people usually don't do in Brazil or in any other country. And especially his elder son, who is a senator from Rio, is under suspicion.
So, Mauricio, is that it then? The investigation is over? And if it's over, what government entity is charged with being a corruption watchdog now?
Well, the federal police and the federal prosecutors, they are still going on with other investigations of corruption. So it's very difficult to find corruption, and we should not think that superheroes are going to solve all the problems. It's something that it has to begin with society, with a change of values, with a change of behavior from the voters.
That's Mauricio Santoro, a political scientist at the State University of Rio de Janeiro. Mauricio, thank you for being with us and explaining this.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure.
Kamchatka in eastern Russia is a sparsely populated peninsula about the size of California. It's known for its active volcanoes and pristine beaches, and right now, an environmental mystery. The world's Anna Kusmer has more.
Kamchatka is a magnet for surfers. In mid-September, some of them started to notice something was wrong with the water.
I felt pain in my eyes after surfing, after a few hours. I didn't feel anything like this before.
Maxim Ionov is a surfer from Sochi who said the water burned his eyes and temporarily blinded him.
It was like a smoke. I couldn't see faces of my friends, like 3 meters, and I couldn't see anything.
Over the past month, dead animals started to wash onto shore. Fish, seals, sea urchins, and starfish covered area beaches. Scientists in the area say 95% of local marine life has died. Local tour guide Christina Rosenberg has posted videos almost every day of what she's seeing on the beach. In one from this week, she points to 2 dead octopuses splayed out on the rocks. She says it's like a nightmare, like a graveyard. Under the surface, recent videos show the ocean floor covered in dead animals, the water a hazy gray yellow. Scientists are racing to figure out what invisible scourge is causing all of this. Right now, it's a mystery.
And we still don't know what is the reason of that impact.
Alexei Knizhnikov is with World Wildlife Fund Russia. His group worked with Greenpeace Russia to take samples from the Kamchatka beaches. They're being analyzed in a Moscow lab right now. One thing they know so far, this is not an oil spill.
No, this is new stuff. This time we don't know what is the source, what is the substance, how to deal with it.
The Russian government says it's investigating several potential sources of pollution, like nearby sites where pesticides are stored. There are also several military bases nearby where toxic rocket fuel is tested and used. Knizhnikov says they'll know a lot more in the next couple days. He says whatever is happening in Kamchatka right now, it's part of a bigger story about Russia's lack of ability to catch stuff like this before it happens.
Unfortunately, after collapse of Soviet Union, a lot of good environmental monitoring program was destroyed.
Knizhnikov says Russia doesn't have a good system to monitor industrial pollution, so people are forced to react to environmental problems like this one after the fact. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
This next story is about wildlife conservation with a dash of James Bond spycraft. Many species of sea turtles are classified as endangered, some critically. One big threat to their survival is where they lay their eggs, on beaches. Poachers can come and steal those eggs before they hatch. So biologist Kim Williams-Guillen had an idea. Create a fake egg with a GPS tracker inside. These egg decoys are called Invest-Egg-Gators, and they were recently deployed in a trial in Costa Rica. Kim Williams-Guillen joins us now. She's a conservation scientist at the environmental nonprofit Paso Pacifico and an adjunct professor at the University of Michigan. So a 3D printed decoy turtle egg, Kim, it's a pretty unusual approach. How'd you come up with this idea?
The idea was very much in response to something called the Wildlife Crime Tech Challenge. They announced a competition looking for ways in which technology could be used to address and combat trafficking in wildlife and wildlife products. So I puzzled over it for a few days before I kind of had an aha moment of thinking of putting a GPS transmitter in a false sea turtle egg so that we could find out where the turtle eggs were going once they left the beaches that we were trying to protect.
Do the decoy eggs look and feel like real turtle eggs? Like if I were to pick up both, could I tell the difference?
Turtle eggs are kind of soft and squishy with a leathery shell. And we make the false egg with a 3D printer using a very flexible filament so that the egg itself feels a little bit kind of like a stress ball almost. It feels a lot like it.
So I want to know about the trial run, but first, why are real sea turtle eggs being stolen?
In Central America, there's kind of a particular cachet to them as being a little bit of an aphrodisiac in the way that people sometimes say oysters are. You might be at a bar, have a raw turtle egg in a shot glass, pour some spicy chili on top of it, slam it down, and then slam down a beer or a shot of rum to follow it up.
So the investigators had a trial run, basically, in Costa Rica, and the findings were published this week in the journal Current Biology. How did this trial work, and what were the results?
So the first author on the paper is Helen Feezy. She's a PhD student who was studying turtle egg poaching and the illegal commerce in Costa Rica. And when she would come across a turtle that was digging its nest, she would place one of the investigators activated inside the nest. Many of the nests were not taken, and Helen was able to recover the eggs. But in many cases, the poachers did, in fact, take the egg along with the nest.
Then what happens? What is the goal of all this?
We actually often know who's poaching. And especially when you do like Paso Pacifico does, where we're really training local community members to work in turtle conservation, including some former turtle egg poachers. So it wasn't that we wanted to know who the poacher is and to get them, but rather where the egg was traveling when it's out of their hands. Because if it's just going to local markets, your local environmental education and intervention is sufficient. If it's traveling to the capital city, then it suggests that perhaps you need an interregional or national level interventions.
Are you saying you actually flipped some poachers who are now helping you to protect the turtle eggs?
Yes. What's driving a lot of local poachers is being in poverty in undeveloped rural areas. So they're not taking eggs because they hate turtles. It's that they have relatively few economic opportunities. And unless we can offer them some other different way by hiring and training them and making use of their local ecological knowledge, then if we stop them from poaching, we're kind of stopping them from having a means of supporting themselves and their families. For us, it's not so much about getting a particular bad guy, but trying to understand the drivers behind it and being able to design the interventions that are going to be most effective.
Kim Williams-Guillen is a conservation scientist at the environmental nonprofit Paso Pacifico. Thanks very much for explaining this to us. This is fascinating.
Thank you, Marco.
From the Nana Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Be safe out there and stay healthy. We'll see you back here on Monday.